This is Gabriel Adels. Welcome to the Gabe Tour podcast, in which I read from my book and play songs that I recorded about the experiences described. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the ride. I waited for the ferry to Whidbey Island, clutching the handlebars of my brand new surly long-haul trucker. As my mind wandered, the bicycle tipped, surprisingly unwieldy when laden with camping gear. I caught it, brought it back to center, and resumed my anticipation of day one's potential complications. The clouds over the Puget Sound would soon burst, but when I chose to start my trip in the Pacific Northwest, I knew I'd be getting rained on sooner or later. If I got a flat tire, I wasn't sure I'd remember how to patch it. Hopefully I'd make it to a campground before dark. If I didn't, maybe I'd ring someone's doorbell and ask to sleep in their yard. I dialed Adam and listened to the warm tones. Though we'd originally planned to start together on Vancouver Island, he had booked his airfare without consulting me on my timing, and beat me there by a week, which he'd spent meandering around a campsite alone. He picked up. "It's so good to hear your voice. You're the first person I've spoken to in 3 days." I restrained myself from blaming him for his predicament, choosing my words carefully. "I'm sorry I'm not there with you." He sighed a distorted breath into the speaker. "I'm sorry to say that I don't think I'll be much fun when you get here. Me and Annie just broke up." "You don't have to apologize for that. How do you feel?" He stuttered in consideration. My chest hurts a lot. It literally feels like my heart is broken." "I know what you mean." "Look, Gabe, I don't know how much more of this I can take. I feel like I might need to go home to San Diego." At this point, I'd have to go forward with my trip, regardless of Adam's company. I visualized myself in the midst of my route down the Pacific coast. Peering from above, perhaps through my brother Jonah's eyes, I see myself standing on a ridge, soaked in a pink sunset across the ocean. Nobody else is around, just me on the ground and Jonah in the sky. For a second, it seems like solitude might be my only way to connect with him. Just as quickly as the reverie arrived, it disappeared. Its tone struck me as absurdly sentimental. I didn't need to face this somberly. I needed companionship and to have fun. Adam and I agreed to travel on Route 525, respectively heading north and south, until we inevitably crossed paths. From there, he would make his decision, one that would drastically impact the next year of my life. I hung up as the massive ferry arrived, and wheeled my bike through the rows of parked cars on board. The rain started, a spray, blending the overcast sky with the sound. Through a window, I scanned the gray for whales, a sign that Jonah was with me at the beginning of my trip. I felt bad for Adam about the breakup, but also knew that if he hadn't been alone at that campsite on Vancouver Island, he would never have reached this level of panic. Now he was on the verge of canceling the entirety of our post-college plans. Since we'd met as freshmen at Bard, I couldn't understand why he constantly isolated himself like this. Our sophomore year, he rented a room off campus with a middle-aged woman and her son. His shyness cemented him in a prolonged seclusion before he decided to transfer to UCLA, which he hated. He returned to Bard for senior year, where we lived together in a giant house full of close friends. If I had intervened as a sophomore and stopped him from moving, I might have spared him the hassle of 2 lonely years. Still, though he admitted he was miserable, he never seemed to regret them. Whidbey Island arrived too quickly. I took cover in a public bathroom, digging out the rain gear from my panniers. The weather had only intensified and showed no signs of letting up. There wasn't going to be a better time to start. I zipped up my jacket and pants, latched the Velcro straps, and leapt in. Within minutes, the rain had soaked through my armor. Route 525 turned out to be a highway with a slim shoulder. I followed it inland, where a forest of Douglas fir blocked my view of the sound. Cars whizzed by uncomfortably close, leaving me no choice but to inhale their exhaust, which also made my eyes tear. The fully loaded bike was hard to control, and I had to concentrate on keeping my swerves contained within the white line. My stomach growled. Somehow I'd forgotten about food. I sought shelter in the first grocery store. Wrapping my cable and U-lock around the wheels hardly assuaged my paranoia that someone might rummage through my luggage. I wanted to linger in the familiar glow of the aisles, but given I was dripping wet, the air conditioning felt like a refrigerator. I left with supplies for PB&Js, but couldn't figure out where to store them in the rig. As it was, my panniers barely closed. I'd stuffed one with the tent, a pot, and the stove. The other held my sleeping bag and clothes. Bungee cords secured my miniature guitar and the green backpack I'd inherited from Jonah. I shoved the glass jars and bread inside of it. Within a few minutes of riding, something didn't feel right. I looked behind my shoulder to find the backpack hanging onto the rack by a single strap. After stopping to reconfigure the bungees, I tried to check the GPS on my phone. Moisture masked the screen, preventing me from tracking my progress. I had missed a call from Adam, who didn't pick up when I tried back. I pulled into a state park and sat on top of a picnic bench to make a sandwich. It had stopped raining. Dim rays of sunlight shone through the evergreens. I couldn't imagine continuing like this for the rest of the day, let alone months. Google Maps recommended residential roads that wound along either side of the highway. After lunch, I switched routes, and though circuitous, the gentle hills and ocean views were much more akin to what I'd expected of Whidbey Island. Nestled within the trees, suburban homes peered out onto the water, sporting Seattle Seahawks flags. Before long, a steep incline disrupted my respite. The curves tightened, snaking up hills that, after a long morning, I doubted my ability to master. I crawled past a message, spray-painted on the side of the road. Shut up, legs. I laughed, relieved to have found the correct route. Only a fellow cyclist could have written it. After a long day of riding, my legs indeed felt like disembodied entities, which reluctantly heeded my brain's commands. They begged for rest, and I had to continually override the message. The image of my broken leg with toes pointed backwards hovered in my mind's eye. At first, it hadn't hurt. The signal between my leg and brain temporarily ruptured. I had told the leg to move, but it wouldn't respond. It remained silent for the first few minutes, but when the shock wore off, my leg remembered how to scream. I had been driving through Wisconsin with Jonah when I swerved to avoid a deer. I had lost control of the vehicle, and a truck smashed into the passenger side. When I woke up, my leg was broken and Jonah was unconscious. The next day, I had a steel rod hammered through my femur. Jonah remained in a coma for 3 months before he died. 1 year later, I was here, scaling a hill in rural Washington. My legs pleaded for me to stop, but I refused. "My body's a machine," I whispered to them. I repeated the phrase, my feet circling with each pedal. "My body's a machine. My body's a machine. I am not my body. I am not my body." I added lines, distracting myself and mustering strength through the rhythm in the phrases. "My body's a machine. I am not my body. My body is a vessel that takes me places. My body has life and my body has death. I will love my body till I breathe its last breath. My body's a machine. I am not my body. My body is a vessel that takes me places. My body has life and my body has death. I will love my body till I breathe its last breath. By 4 p.m., I reached the ferry station to Port Townsend, 35 grueling miles from where I'd begun. The next day, we'd cross the Sound here in order to continue down the Olympic Peninsula. A nearby state park where I could camp ensured closure to my first day. I couldn't have imagined it would be so demanding. Adam finally picked up his phone. "I made it to the ferry," I announced. "Where are you?" "We're at Fort Eby State Park. It's 13 miles north of the ferry." "What are you doing there? And who's we?" His voice bounced with unexpected joviality. "I'm with my friend Sean, who I met on the ferry from Vancouver Island. We biked together and decided to camp here. It's a really beautiful spot. If you hurry, you can meet us before dark." It started raining again. "Cool," I said, trying to sound like it was cool. "We're in a pretty hidden site, so call when you get here." "Okay, but don't forget to pick up your phone." How long would this Sean be joining us? I put my rain gear back on and pressed uphill into farmland. Banana slugs descended from the trees, littering a bike path that paralleled the road. After weaving between them, I stopped to examine one, which left a trail of slime after it crawled across my arm. One last hill brought me into the campground as daylight started to fade. I couldn't wait to see the look on Adam's face when I snuck up on him. After circling the loop of campsites twice, I gave up and tried to call. No response. At dusk, I sat in an empty site, allowing the rain to defeat my will. With nothing left to do, I yelled, "Adam!" I listened to the white caps and wet leaves, and then faintly, a thin voice, "Gabe!" In a game of call and response, I followed his voice until a lanky figure bounded from the trees. Our 3 months apart suddenly felt like they'd been years. His likeness forced an irrepressible smile on my face, washing away the frustration. In person, I couldn't be mad at him. So the way that this podcast is going to be formatted is that each episode is going to start with a story, an excerpt from the book, and then I'm going to play songs that relate to those excerpts. So this song that I'm about to play actually was written few months before the story that I just read about the beginning of the bike tour, but mentally and spiritually I was in really a similar place of grieving very deeply and not knowing the right way to go about grieving. So that's sort of what the song is about. And what made me want to include it here also was that there's this conception of my brother in the sky that exists in the song, and I also sort of mention in the book at the beginning when I'm having this reverie about my brother looking down on me as I'm biking down the coast. So that was something that was kind of on my mind at the time, and I was wondering how to connect with him, you know, him being in the sky and looking down on me and me being on earth and wondering why he would even trouble himself with earthly matters like mine. So here it is. Song's called Guesswork.
Life trying to be all of the things.
Jonah had also gone to Bard, and after graduation, drove across the country with his best friends, Jade and Tim. Jade's family farm, Helsing Junction, was their final destination, located 25 miles south of Olympia. They worked as farmhands, living nearby on the hill. Atop a set of steep switchbacks, they erected handmade shelters and subsisted mostly on fresh produce. Jonah and Tim shared a teepee, and Jade lived in a two-story house they'd constructed of mud, straw, and salvage. When I was 16, I visited for a week, spending my days in the fields picking strawberries. Sore from my first foray into manual labor, I barely found the strength to make it up the hill for dinner. Jonah, Jade, and Tim roasted root vegetables in their cob oven. The sweetness of the beets a revelation to me. Adopting their lifestyle challenged me to do without an infinite supply of processed snacks, and I went to bed hungry for the first time. Every summer, they organized a music festival at Helsing Junction, an informal reunion for their class at Bard. After staying with them on the hill, I returned twice for the sleepover, swimming naked in the river, filling our Nalgenes with bulbous wild berries, and dancing in the barn until morning. Now, I was the age they had been when they lived here, building their own houses, growing their own food, and organizing music festivals. Even after so many years, I aspired to be like they were. Though I didn't have an exact address, I led the way down Independence Road with my eyes peeled for familiar sights. A curve that I'd anticipated taking us to the right presented the mirror image of what I remembered. A trampoline I'd jumped on with Jonah appeared on the wrong side of the road. Though disoriented, I allowed flashes of uncanny resemblance to guide me towards the hill. Finally, I viewed the gate like deja vu, as the wind sent waves through the yellow grass on an adjacent slope. I leaned on my handlebars, resisting the bike's careening backwards from weight over the back wheel. Each time I'd walked up this hill, I was surprised by how long it took. I had tried to ride up it once, on a borrowed bike, but I hadn't made it a quarter of the way. Jonah told me that he'd once reached the top, but he'd had a tendency to exaggerate. Adam pointed out the thorn bushes and warned me to be careful. I remembered crawling into them to retrieve our soccer ball, which we had juggled every night after dinner until it got too dark to see. Adam and I finally reached the clearing at the top of the hill, where their village had been. The teepee was gone, leaving only a light green indentation in the grass. The mud hut still stood, though it leaned considerably to one side. A corrugated tin roof hung from the top, the doors and windows sealed. Inside, things looked just as they had been left, as if suddenly evacuated. Cobwebs gripped to once useful relics, an old tea kettle, a mirror smudged with dirt. I hesitated to disrupt the sight, not wanting to handle anything improperly. We walked to a lookout over Independence Valley, where a clear cut had opened up the view. When Jonah first discovered it, wandering through the forest barefoot, he started to cry, feeling the death of an entire ecosystem. I sat there, huddled in the broken twigs, spacing out at my hands. Dread churned in my stomach. I needed to find words, urgently, to diffuse the sorrow before it took its grip. "I want to talk to someone who knew Jonah," I barely choked out to Adam. I reached for my phone, and as he began to walk away, my internal well exploded in streams of rage. He saw me cracking open, but knew to give me space. I fell to my knees, clutching the earth that Jonah had walked on, grabbing handfuls of soil and sifting through it with my fingers. As I cried, I felt the connection between my living and Jonah dying. For a moment, this connection harbored within my chest, perched like a bird testing a flimsy branch. It evaded words, instead seizing my body and forcing it into submission, sweeping my legs out, and guiding me into the dirt as if towards some clue. Dirt where Jonah had planted seeds, dirt like Jonah was buried in. I followed the impulse to curl into a tiny ball, resting my head against the ground and letting my tears feed the soil. Roots below me soaked up the salt. Trees died and seedlings hatched. They might never have existed at all. That night, rain poured loudly on the mud hut's roof. I dreamt, reliving every millisecond of the car crash. Jonah offers me tea, which I sip and continue to drive. The deer appears, a huge buck with antlers. I swerve to the right. The slightest adjustment back to the left sends us sailing across the lanes. I look at Jonah, who tries to sit upright in his seat. I yell, "Shit!" Glass shatters and headlights blare into the car. The impact astonishes me. I hadn't seen another vehicle on the road. The numbing smash of blunt force makes my mind go blank. In the dream, I now feel Jonah's pain in addition to my own, searing, life-piercing. In another place and time, I try to explain to Jonah that I had felt it, but no words come out. Instead, I start to cry, burying my face in his chest as he draws me in. The dream magnifies the sensation of crying, more intense than anything I could feel in waking life, like my chest was ripping open from the inside. We freeze, enraptured within a moment that spans both an instant and an eternity. Adam had spoken with Annie on the phone, and they decided that they needed to be together in person to figure out the state of their relationship. He booked a flight to New York City, which returned in 1 week. I believed him when he assured me that he was coming back. The flight left Portland in 3 days, giving us 2 days to ride 120 miles. It was a stretch, especially considering the pace we'd been keeping. We woke up that morning for an early start. The rain had intensified throughout the night. As we headed down the hill, my back tire dragged. "My first flat," I remarked sardonically. I didn't feel like trying to patch it in the rain, so I asked Adam to replace the tube, hoping to learn from his technique. We each carried two extras, just to be cautious. He wrapped the new tube around the wheel and managed to squeeze the tread over it. I inflated the tire with my handheld pump, breaking a sweat, and loaded up my gear again. As we reached the road, I felt the same lag. "Guess I'll put on another one," Adam said, forcibly calm. Our second attempt failed as well. I was out of spares, so I bought Adam's extras off of him. I cautiously inflated the tube until it popped out of the tire, pinching against the wheel's frame. I yelled for Adam to deflate, but it exploded with a loud pop that rang in my ears. Down to our last one, we looked up an instructional video. This time, instead of stretching the tube around the wheel, we tucked it up into the tire. We proceeded cautiously down Independence Road. If I got another flat, I insisted that Adam should ride to Portland without me. By 1 p.m., we still hadn't left the hill, and my stomach growled. We ate soggy peanut butter and jellies on the side of the road, the chances of making Adam's flight looking increasingly slim. We rode through a few hours of daylight before setting up to sleep in a thicket next to the interstate. Though all of our clothes were soaked, we carefully protected the sleeping bags. When I was almost asleep, Adam became worried that the tent would flood in the middle of the night. It seemed possible, but I refused to get wet again to relocate. At 5:30 the next morning, the rain thumped against the fly, but the inside had remained dry. We had to make it 80 miles that day. My first step was getting out of my sleeping bag. I cringed at the thought of pulling my wet socks and shirt across my skin, but gathered the courage to clad myself in the soiled garments before soberly getting to work. The rain dragged our efforts, and the chill clung to my bones no matter how hard I pedaled. After a long morning, stopped at a red light, I ventured that we should stop for a slice of pizza and hot chocolate. Adam replied, "There is nothing I would like more in the world." Given our budgeted money and time, hot food in a dry place felt extravagant, but the splurge gave us the emotional strength to keep pushing. I paced myself up hills with renewed vigor. In my head, Jonah's voice intoned, "What does it really feel like to be wet? Is it really that bad?" I breathed into the feeling of being soaked, more of a tingle than a tragedy. We crossed the Columbia River on a steep bridge, its small shoulder littered with debris. Adam went first. I concentrated on riding fast and straight to escape the hazards as quickly as possible. Exhausted from the climb, we immediately descended towards Oregon. An exit lane cut through the shoulder, a scenario we never encountered. Adam sailed across the lane without seeing a 16-wheeler approaching from behind. The driver sped up, trying to beat him to the exit. Adam squeezed his brakes and swerved to the right, avoiding contact by inches. I watched the scene unfold in slow motion, disgusted. Another accident wouldn't have surprised me. We reached an entering Portland sign in the late afternoon and knew that Adam would make his flight. As we climbed the approach to St. John's Bridge, leading into northwest Portland, I felt a familiar drag on my back wheel. Out of fresh tubes, we started patching the torn rubber from the previous day. Drivers offered help that I politely refused, bent on proving that we could handle a flat. I loaded up my bags again and coasted across the bridge's cushy bike lane. On the other side, I had another flat. I admitted that I needed to find a bike shop. I looked up, and we happened to be standing directly in front of one. "Only in Portland," I said. We wheeled our muddy bikes inside. Well-dressed commuters stared at us, disheveled after 2 days in the rain. The mechanic didn't do anything drastically different from the method we'd settled on, but he sure made it look easy. I hope you enjoyed the first installment of the Gabe Tour podcast. If you did, please leave a review, which helps get the word out about it, and tell your family and friends. Also, the book from which this is just excerpts is available for purchase via a link in the description. The book's fully illustrated, includes the entire story, and comes with an album. Thank you.